Hi, friends. Welcome to another episode of Deeper Still, a podcast where we carve out space for meaningful conversation about God and life as we seek to pay attention to the ways He calls us to go deeper still in relationship with Him and with one another. My name is Sue Ann Campfield. I have the joy of being the host of this podcast, and I'm so glad you're joining us today. You know, when I record conversations for Deeper Still, I often record them a few weeks before they actually go live so that we can get them ready for our listeners. And during that time, I have the added benefit of just kind of sitting with the conversation. I often let it just turn over in my heart, in my mind. I kind of chew on the contents, you know what I mean, deep in my soul. And I confess that today's conversation has been sitting with me in a really profound way. I've been thinking about why that is, and I think, first of all, it's because we are journeying through a sermon series this Lent as a church called Messy. It's this reminder that life is messy. Life is hard. We need the grace of a holy and loving God just to get through the day, and I am so grateful for that today. I think the other reason it's been sitting with me is just because I'm reminded what an important conversation this really is. It's important for a variety of reasons, but I know for me, it's given me just a new window, new compassion, new empathy for people who struggle with mental health. Did you know that according to the National Institute of Mental Health, it's estimated that 1 in 5 adults who live in the United States live with a mental illness of some kind? That's 1 in 5 adults, friends. It's more than 50 million Americans live with mental illness of some kind. It's people we know. It's people we love. It is people that are us. And so we're going to talk about that today, but we're going to talk about it in a really transparent and a really hope-filled way. So I hope that you will join us for that journey. To help guide us through this conversation, I'm excited to welcome to the podcast Dr. Alan Noble, the author of the award-winning book on getting out of bed, The Gift and Burden of Living. Christianity Today calls this book a deeply personal essay in which Alan Noble considers how carrying on amid great suffering is a powerful witness to the goodness of life and the goodness of God. I have to say, I agree. In addition to writing numerous books, as well as articles for publications like Christianity Today and The Atlantic, Alan's work has been cited in places like The New York Times and The Washington Post. Alan serves as the Associate Professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University and has spoken at colleges and churches around the country on topics related to the church and culture. Friends, I said it before and I will say it again. Today's conversation, I believe, is an important one. And so whatever you're doing, wherever you find yourself, saddle up, settle in, and listen in as Alan and I go deeper still. Well, Alan, it is so great to have you here on Deeper Still. Thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I am so eager to jump into our conversation. I think this is a really important conversation. I think it's a really timely conversation for our culture today. I think it's going to be a really hope-filled conversation. So I am excited about all of those things. We have a lot of ground to cover. But before I get there, the first thing I want to say to you is congratulations on winning Christianity Today's Award of Merit for this book in 2024. What a great honor. I'm just curious, how did you receive that news when you heard?
You know, I found it online just like everyone else. I saw that they, or somebody might have tagged me, I think, and told me, and that was the first. I didn't know it was my first significant award, so I was very excited and very honored because I put a lot of work into this book and wasn't sure that it was going to land. It was a difficult book to write, and so I am thrilled that it has received the credit that it's received.
Well, first of all, I can't believe you didn't get a call like the Oscars do, that someone didn't call you, you know, in the middle of the night and tell you you were nominated or won. So that's really funny that you found out just like the rest of us. I love that. Nothing but a little dose of humility for authors
That's good for the soul. So I love that for that reason, but also because, like you said, I'm sure it was a vulnerable book to write, a vulnerable message to share. You weren't sure how it was going to land on people. I'm curious, what do you think resonated with people?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that people have said is that they felt seen. And so I think the depiction of mental affliction that I described, the depression and anxiety, the day-to-day mundane experience of that, I think that has landed for some people, that they feel like I described what that experience was like in a way that didn't wallow in it and gave hope, but also took it seriously. Because one of the things that can happen in Christian circles is that we don't take mental affliction seriously. We shy away from it. We hide from it. We pretend that we are just joyful all the time, and we don't have mental illness or disorders or affliction. And that's not reality. That's not the real world of the fallen world that we live in. And so for some people who have read the book, I think what's resonated is just the honest depiction of what it's like to go through mental suffering.
Yeah, I think for me, I think that combination of honesty, of hope, of being really clear. You have some real clear call to actions in the book as well. And so it's this beautiful mix of just compassion and empathy, of knowing, of naming, and also of saying there is also some courageous acts that people suffering with mental afflictions can take in order to walk through their everyday life. And I just thought that combination of things was really beautiful. And I'm hoping we're going to get a chance to talk it, maybe not about all of those things, but at least a combination of some of them. So can you take us back and just share a little bit about what prompted you to write this book in the first place?
Yeah. So I was going through some of my own mental struggles, and having a challenging time when a fairly well-known evangelical took his own life. And I reflected at that moment on the significance of what that act means, not just for that person, but for everyone who was watching and paying attention and seeing what was going on. And sort of the question I was wondering is, what does that act of suicide communicate? Because it communicates something. All of our actions communicate things to the world. And so it made me wonder, what does that act communicate? And sort of the answer that I initially came to is that whether that person intended it to or not, it communicated that life itself is not worth living. And the flip side of that, as I meditated on this train of thought, the flip side of that is that when you are going through suffering and you choose to get out of bed, as the metaphor I use in the book, you're also communicating something, and that's the positive side. The positive side is that when you choose to get out of bed despite suffering, you're communicating to the world that life is worth living, that life despite suffering is worth living. And that inspired me to write an essay called On Living that was the seed for this book. And I received a lot of feedback from people. And at the time, I was editing my second book, You Are Not Your Own. And when you're in the editing process, you think your book is terrible. So I was editing one book and feeling just really down in the dumps, feeling like this isn't going to work. And I was getting emails from people saying, this essay you wrote is the most important thing you've written. It's the best thing you've written. And I thought, well, if this book is annoying me, I'm sick of it, and these other people are telling me this other book or this other essay is great, maybe I should just turn that into a book. And so I contacted my editor, and he said, yes, go for that. So I did.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you chose to listen to the work of God in your life and through other people. And just, I think that's often how you know something's important when other people are saying this is important, you've got to keep going with this. And so that's always a good test to see what messages, you know, sometimes we think we have the best messages in the world that we're putting out there. And then the one thing that maybe we aren't as considerate of is the thing that really sticks with people. And so I'm really glad that you listen to those voices.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Alan, you share kind of starting out in the book that as a kid, when you saw people living a normal, happy life, that oftentimes you thought this is what life is. This is what was owed to you. If you make the right choices, if you do the right things, if you, you know, if you go to college and you have a family and you go to church and you're a kind person, that this equates to a happy life. And you learned somewhere along the journey that that is a little bit of a myth. And I'm wondering if you can share how and what you learned about that.
Yeah. So as you said, my initial understanding of the world growing up was that you just had to hustle hard and life and be a good Christian and life would be comfortable and easy. And there would be accidents, but other than that, things would go well. And what happened was I started getting into small group Bible studies with people as an adult, as a young adult, and then in my 20s, maybe that's still young adult, I don't know. And I started to get to know people really well. And that was an interesting experience for me because I had known people before, but I thought, you know, the people I knew, I thought the suffering that they were experiencing was their own fault. And that if they were just good Christians, they wouldn't have these problems. But I started to get to know adults who on the outside had their lives together and they were really doing things the right way and they were pursuing things and they were making all the right life choices. And I'd get into these small group Bible studies and find out that they had these dark secrets, that these burdens that they were carrying, that their marriages were crumbling, that they were suffering in some ways. And I realized most people carry a lot of baggage, that life is actually a lot harder than we like to admit. And the modern world encourages us not to talk about that. It encourages us to not talk about that because it's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of weakness. And so we keep our scars hidden from each other. And it's really just in these very private spaces of for me, small group Bible studies, but there could be other spaces where people really divulge what's actually going on in their lives and the struggles that they are facing. And that made me rethink things. It made me realize, okay, suffering is normal. I shouldn't have had to come to that conclusion because the world has known this forever. Humanity has known this forever. The church has known this forever. Suffering is a normal part of human existence. It's not the anomaly. But the contemporary world likes to hide that. And it likes to say that if you're suffering, you just haven't bought the right product. You don't have the right life coach, or you're not following the right Instagram guru. The real world is a lot harder and a lot scarier, and it requires a lot more courage than we like to admit.
You know, it's one of the things I am reminded of often as someone who's in pastoral ministry, is you hear people, we're in a church context where everyone looks really good. We have a really pretty church. We have a lot of very successful people. And I think in pastoral ministry and not just as a pastor on staff, but I know, you know, your experience in a small group, when you start hearing people's stories, you just start to, you know, have your eyes opened to the amount of pain and suffering people are carrying that you would never know. And I know coming to that realization, having people trust me with their stories is one of the ways that my heart has been softened. My eyes have been opened. You know, it just helps you see the people that you're looking at who look really great on the outside. And you start to realize everyone is carrying this story. You say in your book that 9 times out of 10, people are carrying around something incredibly painful, incredibly tragic. I'm wondering, for people who are suffering, what do you say to them? As I know you have to have safe places to share your story. And so I imagine you wouldn't tell everyone just to go around telling everyone your story. But I imagine there are places where you would encourage people to tell their story. And so that I'll stop right there. That's my first question. What do you say to people who are walking around telling everyone they're fine when they're not?
Yeah. So I would say a couple things. First of all, in everyday conversation, it's perfectly appropriate to use the polite phrase, I'm doing great or I'm doing well, because not everybody needs to know your burdens. Not everybody should know your burdens. Not everybody has earned the right to hear your story. And so that's on one side. The other side is you can't carry this alone. And that's one of the things that I come back to repeatedly in the book is the importance of community. If you don't have someone that you're talking to, you need to find someone. And that might be an uncomfortable process of going to your church and sharing things with people who, you know, you haven't spent years with, that you don't have extensive relationships with. But you have to go outside of your, you have to take a risk. You have to take the plunge and speak and share your story with someone who you believe to be likely to be trustworthy and safe, because it's going to be too much for you at one point or another. And I would say for those of you who are not suffering right now, you need to find those people and cultivate those relationships starting now, starting today. Start cultivating relationships that you can depend on when you go through difficult times, because one of the promises, one of the guarantees that we have in life is that we're going to suffer. It's going to happen. Our loved ones are going to pass away. Our successes are going to turn to failures, accidents, tragedies, mistakes. Things are going to happen to us, and we need to be ready for those. And so we've got to be intentional. And the older I get, the more intentional I have to be about creating friendships, because they don't just happen. When you're younger, you just sort of fall into friendships. You go to the same class, you're in the same team, whatever it might be, and things just naturally occur. And that's great. But in adulthood, in late adult, mid and late adulthood, you have to hustle. The same effort you put into finding a spouse, you've got to put into finding friends. Mm-hmm. You've got to shop around. You've got to connect with people. You've got to stretch yourself and put yourself out there and take risks, because friends are going to help carry you through difficult times.
I think that's one of the things I know I have learned. Just, it's amazing the way when you start to do life with people over time and you journey together well, and then those things happen. I have a dear friend, one of my best friends for 20 years now. She was my first friend when my husband and I first moved to Chicago. And little did I know that probably 15 years into our friendship, she would lose her son in a tragic accident. And you don't know when you're building those relationships what you're going to need to be there for later. And that's just one story of a lot of stories we hold like that. And it just causes you to step back and say, God, you know, I don't know what the future holds. I don't know what's going to happen with these relationships, but I'm going to steward them well. And you realize in times of trouble why it's so important to be so intentional.
Yeah. I think that's a great example. And the key, what's interesting there is, you're not the one primarily in the position of suffering. And so that's an angle I didn't mention, is that you need to build these relationships intentionally now, because you don't know how you're going to need to show up for someone in their lives. And this is the beautiful thing about, one of the beautiful things about the church, is that we can carry each other's burdens. But in an isolating and alienating and individualizing world, you're going to need to put some intentionality into cultivating these relationships, because they're probably not going to just happen on their own. And that's got to be okay.
That's right. That's right. Now, Alan, when we're in relationship, one of the things that we want to do is help. We want to carry each other's burdens. And probably when we're dealing with mental health, there are ways that we can help one another, and there's ways we can injure one another. And you do talk about in the book. I think one of the things I learned is we want to be helpful. And so when we hear someone is struggling, we try to say, oh, hey, you should read this book that I read. Maybe this can help you. You should try this seminar. Listen to this podcast. You know, we're an endless suggestion box of questions, and we want to help. but often that's not helpful. But the eye-opening thing for me is you said one of the reasons that is not helpful is because when we try to fix people, it actually causes them to further isolate themselves, because all we do is remind them of all of the things that they have tried already to and failed at. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality of when you're going through a difficult time. You know, mental health, mental illness, mental affliction, however you want to frame it, is a complicated, a highly complicated thing. It's not like, you know, you've got a broken arm or something where you can get very clear treatment that will fix the problem, and then you just need to get the bone set and put it in a cast and give it time and it takes care of itself. It's not like that. It's complicated. And there are lots of people with lots of different pieces of advice. And the reality is, you know, take psychological medication. Antidepressants are a fascinating thing. We don't really understand why they work. We just know that they work for some people sometimes in some ways, which is fascinating. Like most things with medication, we kind of know why something works and we understand the mechanism, but we don't really understand the mechanism with SSRIs. But we do know that studies have shown that they can really help. They can be lifesavers to some people, but only some people. Some people take them and they don't do anything. And that feels really weird. That feels frustrating to us because we want clear answers. I take this drug and I get cured. Well, a lot of times with SSRIs, you've got to try one drug after another drug after another drug to find the one that works. And sometimes you don't find one that works. And that's just an example in the medical aspect of how, in general, there's just a lot of possible treatments, possible answers to what you're going through, and to respond to what you're going through. So when somebody comes to you with, you know, an answer, a solution, a treatment, a process, a method, a technique to get better, one of the things that can happen is it reminds you of how many different things you've tried that haven't actually worked. Now, that's not to say that you should never offer suggestions or recommendations, but I think we need to walk carefully. We need to weigh our words and consider, is this really going to be helpful right now? Are they in a place to hear this right now? Are they looking for solutions? Because very often, one of the things that we need is just someone to say, I'll be there for you. It's going to be okay. I mean, that's what a lot of people need to hear, is just somebody saying to them, it's going to be okay. And they don't need recommendations of books or podcasts or seminars or experts. So we need to be judicious about how we give recommendations.
That's really helpful, really wise. Yeah. Ellen, the question at the heart of your book is why. You do a beautiful job painting a picture of what it might look like for certain people facing certain mental illnesses, what that looks like, really eye-opening stories that you tell. I, as someone who doesn't struggle with mental health, it was really helpful for me to hear some of those stories to paint a different reality of what that might be like for someone else. But the question at the heart of your book is really why. And you say when you're suffering, each morning you wake up, this is the title of your book, you wake up and you have to decide that I'm going to get out of bed. So if someone were in that situation and they were saying, gosh, I need a why do I need to get out of bed every day? What would you say to them about building that why? Why is it so important?
Yeah. So the question, why get out of bed, is fundamentally the question, why live? In the book, I try to argue that we need an answer to this question, that fundamentally, all of us need to have an answer for the question, why live? And choosing to get out of bed is choosing to embrace life. And choosing to stay in bed is choosing to question the meaning of life. Now, I want to pause there and have a little caveat and acknowledge that there are some times, there are some people who go through some periods where they can't get out of bed because of their mental affliction, that it's that serious and they need serious intervention to get that help. So I want to acknowledge and not... not overlook those people. But for most of us, the challenge to get out of bed, the courage to get out of bed, demands a lot of us. And the answer, I think, to why get out of bed is that God made us, that we are created in His image, and life is fundamentally good. Even though it's really hard, it is fundamentally good. When we choose to get out of bed, in the book, I argue that we are echoing God's "it is good" in Genesis. That we are echoing His, we are affirming, we are going alongside God and saying, "I agree with you that it is good that I exist," because God made us and He sustains us, and we are alive moment by moment because of Him. And that's a beautiful gift. The why to get out of bed is that life is a beautiful gift. Now, when you're going through a period of suffering, you're going to doubt that. It's going to feel like life is not a gift, it's a burden. And that's part of the subtitle of my book, The Burden and Gift of Living. And I do recognize that. But that's why it's so important to have your why nailed down before you go through a time of struggle, because then you can know when you go through difficult times, you can know, okay, even though subjectively I feel like life is not worth living, objectively I know that it is a good and beautiful thing. There are nice things in the world, nice things that are worth pursuing. And even no matter how grim things feel, those nice things remain, those beautiful things remain, and they're worth pursuing, they're worth enjoying. So the answer to why live is because God created us and He sustains us moment by moment in an act of love. And we ought to affirm that love because He knows better than we do that life is worth living.
Yeah, I love that you say you need to have an answer for this question before you get out of bed in the morning, that there will be times where you're not going to have, when you really need an answer to that question, you're not going to have the time, or you're not going to have the energy, you're not going to have the strength, you're not going to have what you need to answer that question. And so having that framework, how important that is to have that as kind of your foundation. And really it's theological. I mean, that's what you're saying. This is the answer to this question is really theological.
Yes. Yes. Fundamentally, it is theological. It is the principle that our preservation, our existence itself, is an active work of creation by God. We can kind of get what would be called a deist view of God, this idea that God created us and then He leaves us alone and we just go on with our lives. But the act of being created by God continues moment by moment. God is creating us, is sustaining our existence. That's an active work by God. And so if He's actively sustaining us, there must be a reason for that. He must be because He loves us. And so it is fundamentally a theological answer to the question why.
When people think about reasons to get out of bed, because what you could do if you don't have that theological reason, if you aren't looking at life as a gift, sometimes the reason to get out of bed is because you have this fun thing you are going to do. There is something pleasure that you're going to look forward to. Sometimes it's because you're busy. Right? If I can just keep busy, that's my reason to get out of bed. But you say, unless the reason we choose to go on living is something greater than pleasure or freedom from pain, or even hope for a better tomorrow, then we miss out on the why.
Yeah. Yeah. All those other things eventually are going to let you down. The pleasure will disappoint you. The hope that think tomorrow will be better will disappoint you. You know, our busyness will overwhelm us. It's got to be bigger than that. And our hope, we do have hope that tomorrow will be better than today. Maybe not literal tomorrow, but a future redemption is what we are hoping in. But that hope is a hope that's bigger than us. It's based in God. And fundamentally, what you'll hear a lot of people say to this question when they don't want to give a theological answer is, it's important for you to get out of bed because to embrace life because we need you. That need is only based on our usefulness. So what happens when we stop being useful? What happens when we are infirm? What happens when we don't have something to offer the world? Is it still true that our lives are worth living? So if our value is tied to our usefulness, then we're eventually going to get to a place where we don't have the usefulness that makes life worth living. But what I argue in the book is that we have no use value to God. God doesn't actually need us. God is self-sustaining, self-sufficient, all-knowing, all-powerful. He doesn't need us. He created us because he loves us, which is better than being needed by God. Where it's not that we're needed by God, it's that we're loved by God, and he uses us for his good purposes. And so that's a why that extends beyond the secular why that is so often proclaimed in psychological spaces.
Yeah, you wrote a beautiful article for Christianity called Getting Out of Bed is an Act of Worship. And I think that's what you're hinting at, to think about that is an act of worship in response to the love of a good and gracious God.
Yeah, you know, we often think of our theological act of worship as being prayer or sacrificing our desires, but we don't often think about those desires being peace. And sometimes what we sacrifice is our peace. It's a false peace, but it's a peace nevertheless. So the scenario here is when you are lying in bed or sitting somewhere and you want to give up on life. You want to stop working, stop fighting, stop feeding your dog, stop caring for your children, stop showing up at work, because life feels unbearable. Life feels fundamentally just too hard. And in those moments, you want to embrace a kind of false peace, what I would call it, false peace, of despair, of just giving up, because it's hard. It takes a great deal of courage to deny that pull towards giving up and embrace life. And so I think it's an act of worship. It's an act of sacrifice, to sacrifice your suffering and embrace life, to show up for people, to care for people, to love people, despite the feelings that you have, despite how difficult things might be for you, you show up for people. And I think that's an act of worship. It glorifies God. It says to other people, it says to your loved ones, your life is worth living. This is worth pursuing. This is worth fighting for, even though it's really hard for me right now.
I think it also ties in to the point you make about, you started the podcast this way when you shared that part of the reason you wrote this book is you watched someone take their life that is in Christian ministry and influence, and this idea that your life is a witness, that all of our actions speak to the goodness of God, that they speak to his nature, his character, his love for us. And the fact that when you are suffering and you choose to get out of bed every day, you actually have a witness in the world that is really powerful.
Yeah.
Impact that a little bit for us.
Yeah. And so, you know, the way I framed it at the beginning and the way I'd frame it now is that there is a burden that we have. We need to recognize that when we give up on life, it invites other people to give up on life too. And that's a heavy burden. But what I want to focus on, and I'm not adding any burden onto anyone who's already going through something difficult. Instead, what I want to do is invite them to see how they can be a blessing to other people. People are watching us all the time. People that we don't even know. And they're watching us whether we want them to or not. And that's, I think, key to this idea of witness. We are a witness to the goodness of God's creation, whether we want to be or not. People are watching us. They're watching to see how we respond, how we deal with suffering. And, you know, you might not have signed up to be a role model, to be a model of what it looks like to live a difficult life. But if you're a human being, you are. People are watching you and they want to see how you will respond in times of trouble. But there's something exciting too, because one of the first things to go when you go through a mental period of mental suffering, one of the first things to go is your sense of worth. You feel like you're worthless, like you're a burden to people, that you're not contributing, that you're not offering anything to people. And what I want to say is, just by getting out of bed and showing up, you are contributing something profound to the world. You might not be giving your 100%, you might not be even giving your 30%, but showing up communicates something to the world. It communicates that this life is good. It's fundamentally good. It's fundamentally beautiful. It's fundamentally worth living. And what's going to happen is your resilience is going to model resilience for other people. And when other people go through difficult times, they're going to see that and they're going to think, oh, well, Alan persevered through this difficult time. I can too. And so that's a gift we get to give to other people. And that's exciting.
And you call it brave.
Yeah, I think in the book, I say something like, normal everyday life takes a great deal of courage. It takes bravery. We like to reserve the term brave and courageous for soldiers and first responders. But I don't think we do a disservice to the words brave or courageous by noting that normal life takes a great deal of courage. Being a parent takes a great deal of courage. Getting married takes a great deal of courage. Being a friend takes a great deal of courage, because you don't know what difficulties you're going to face, but you do know that you're going to face some difficulties. And that means that you're going to have to stand up and continue fighting, continue living, putting one foot before another, moving on, even when you feel like you can't keep moving. And that is brave, and that is worth praising. That is worth commending.
Well, now people listening, maybe there's some people saying, okay, I know we're just scratching the surface. I encourage people, get this book, get this book, get this book. Alan, you're such a beautiful writer, and this book, I think, is so profound.
Thank you.
And it's going to be a gift to so many. And so if I didn't say it enough, get this book if you're listening. But, you know, this is whetting people's appetite, thinking about their why, thinking about, you know, what is that theological reason, especially for people who are suffering, thinking about their life as a gift. And so once people can kind of get there, once they get their minds around, all right, I need a bigger why, and I'm going to sit with that. Then the next question becomes how. Okay. Now, how do I get out of bed every morning? Once I decide to sit up and put my feet on the floor, what comes next?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about doing the next thing, and we need to think about doing the next thing in very discrete terms. So putting your feet on the floor and then asking yourself, what do I need to do next? I need to eat breakfast. And it might seem trivial to think on those levels, but it's profoundly important, because when you are struggling, you often fail to do basic life tasks. And feeding yourself, having a nutritious breakfast can fall by the wayside. You stop caring for yourself. You stop showering. So doing things like getting up, eating breakfast, going outside and getting some sunshine and moving your body is part of what we need to do. Showering, brushing your teeth, contacting a friend, having some real meaningful social interactions. And if you are in a dark place and you haven't already reached out for professional help, I encourage people to do so. I think in this life, you need to reach out for help on two different levels when you're going through a very dark time. You need to reach out for professional help, to a counselor, to a psychiatrist, but you also need to reach out to friends. We, I think, have professionalized a lot of mentoring. We've done a good thing by encouraging people to seek professional mental health help. But we've done a disservice to pastors and elders and older people and wise people, just people in our community who we can turn to and just say, I'm going through this difficult time, and receive basic human mentoring and encouragement. And so I would say part of the how has to be reaching out to others on a personal level and a professional level to get the help that you need to move forward. Being an advocate for yourself can be a huge difference maker in your recovery.
Well, that's a reminder on a couple different levels. Again, this whole conversation, I'm having kind of two different listeners in mind. One is going to be that person who is suffering from a mental affliction, and they are finding so much hope and courage in your words. And yeah, there are other people who are going to be listening, who are loving someone. They are the friend. They are the person who is loving someone who is going through this. We currently, as a church, are going through our Lenten sermon series. It's called Messy, the Challenge of Loving People Like Jesus. And I just had the opportunity to preach about the man who has been lying by the pool of Bethesda for 38 years. And yeah, looking at that through both lenses, through the lens of the person who has been lying there for 38 years, unable to help himself, and the person who is loving that person. And I'm just wondering, I think one of the words of encouragement that as I have sat with this for the people who are loving those people is to not give up, right?
Yeah.
There are times, and you say this in the book, there are times where it's difficult to love a person who has been lying by the side of the pool for a long time. And the tendency is to lose patience quickly, to give up, to judge, you know, all kinds of things, which doesn't help the person who's lying by the side of the pool either. And so I'm wondering, what would you say to people who are loving people as well as they go through this journey together?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing I'd say is that you need support too. So, you need to know that you need people to talk to that can help bear your burdens, because if you become a lifeline for someone without having your own lifeline, you will end up drowning as well. It will be too much. It will be too much. And one thing that can happen is that people who are particularly prone to being a supporter, a listener, a good listener, they can take on other people's burdens empathetically and not share their own burdens with other people, because they feel like I'm not worthy. Other people are suffering so much more than me, so I shouldn't be a burden to anyone else. So the first thing I would say is you need to find support system yourself. You know, the first support system obviously is God and the Holy Spirit, but you need to find other people who can walk alongside you and help you through difficult times. And the closer in proximity you are to that person suffering, so for example, if you're a spouse as opposed to a friend, the more important it is to find that source of encouragement for them, for yourself. The other thing I would say is that, just as you mentioned, that it's important to be patient. Recovery from mental illness, just like from physical illness, can be time-consuming and is not linear. People go up and they start getting better, and then they have setbacks and lapses. And it's important to be a source of hope for someone else without the expectation that things are going to be smooth sailing and just always moving upward in a linear fashion. Things are going to be messy, and we need to expect that and have patience for that. It's also, I think, important to know your boundaries. Although you're there to help, love, and care for someone else, you need to know when you need to stop and take a break and move and go exercise or watch a TV show or take a walk or call a friend or do something else. Because what we don't want, again, is two people who are burnt out and exhausted. That doesn't do anybody any good. So I think an important lesson is to know your own boundaries.
We have mentioned suicide a couple of times along the way. It's a hard thing to talk about. It's a hard word even for me to get out of my mouth. But yeah. I'm wondering, just one step further in this conversation, if you are either in that spot yourself, or someone is listening who's trying to help someone who feels like that could be a real possibility, that ideation is actually happening, what do you have an added word you would say to those two friends?
I think the most important thing is to get immediate professional help, to take it seriously. The other thing I would say is that, beautiful gift from a loving God, and it's okay if you don't feel like it's a gift from a loving God right now. It's okay if subjectively you feel like your life is a burden to yourself and to others. It's okay to feel those things, but the reality is something deeper and truer, and you're going to need to trust me, and you're going to need to trust people who love you when they say that your life is a beautiful gift and it's worth embracing and loving and enjoying. And sometimes in life, we can't trust our feelings, and we can't trust our feelings, but sometimes particularly we can't trust our feelings and even our thoughts. Our minds will justify despair, and we have to, in those times, be willing to turn to others who love us and who can see more clearly, and we need to trust them and their perspective. And that's not often easy to do, but it's what is necessary.
Are there any scripture passages you hold on to? Any things you feel like can really be a difference maker?
For me personally, I've been meditating a lot on Romans 8, and I don't know the verse number, but when Paul says that we are not given a spirit of slavery to fall back into sin, but a spirit of adoption as sons to cry, Abba, Father. To me, that's just a profound passage that reminds me that my being in the world, my what we would call ontology, my existence is sonship, belonging to God. Not slavery to sin, into the flesh, into my mind, into my fears, into my anxieties. Subjectively, it often doesn't feel that way, but objectively, that's the case. And so I often turn to those passages in Romans 8, really all of Romans 8, to be reminded of the gospel truth. Yeah.
It's really good. I know one of the things you say towards the end of the book is you encourage people or remind people that your mind can lie to you. You know, your mind is lying to you. And that's part of those trusting other people who can speak truth into your life. And I think also trusting God's word. I know sometimes I don't mean that to be cliche, but trusting the truth of who he says we are in his word also, and holding on to some of those. And you have some great other passages in the book as well that I think, again, by the book, but I think people will find some real hope and courage in those as well. So thank you for being so vulnerable, and thank you for talking about something that I know is not easy to talk about.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Alan, I have one last question for you before we go. I cannot believe our time is about up. I have a zillion more questions for you that I don't have time to ask you. But I do have one more question that I ask every guest who comes on the show. This podcast is called Deeper Still. And the reason it's called Deeper Still is because we recognize that we are all a work in progress, that there all comes moments in our lives when we kind of think we've got this one thing figured out, or maybe we're over this particular, you know, struggle in our lives. And God just, in his graciousness and kindness, he always reminds us that he's calling us to go deeper still. And so if you would do me the privilege and the honor, I would love for you to share one area in your life right now where God is calling you to go deeper still.
Oh yeah. So as a father, and yeah, I'll just say as a father, I'm being called to go deeper still. I don't think I'm a bad dad, but I'm not a good dad. I'm not as present and as attentive as I ought to be. And even though being a father is probably the most important role that I feel like I have in my life, the world is such a busy place. It's easy to get wrapped up in it and to not really think about what matters, what ultimately matters, and what's going to have a lasting impact in eternity. And it's going to be my relationship with my kids is going to be probably one of the most, if not the most impactful things in my life. And so I feel like God is really calling me to get deeper into my role as a father.
Well, you know, we talked about the idea of being a witness, and perhaps as a parent, there's no better witness you can be to yeah. who God is and his character, right, than how we move through our everyday lives. And so that's a really, really beautiful way to end the conversation, really good thought for us to consider. So yeah. thanks so much for, again, being here. Congratulations on all the success you have had, not just with this book, but with so many things that you are doing to minister to people and in a variety of different ways with your writing, your teaching. And so just thanks for who you are, and thanks for taking time out of your day to be here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, friends, thanks so much for joining us today. I hope and I pray that you have found some hope in this conversation, some courage, some encouragement. And especially for our friends out there who just need the reminder, who may be struggling today, that getting out of bed is a brave and courageous act. And so we are praying that God's grace and his peace will be with you this day. Before I let you go, I want to point you to just three quick things. First of all, be sure to follow Alan on social media. Check out his website. You can find him at oallennoble.com. Yep, that's the letter O, oallennoble.com. Buy the book. I have said that many times. Buy the book. You can buy on getting out of bed wherever you buy your books. And so be sure to do that before you go today. Whether you are suffering or you love someone who is, this book is such a beautiful resource. I can't encourage you enough. Get this book. Put it on your shelf. Well, many of you know, I record this podcast as a staff member of Christ Church. And last year, we recorded a 4-part series of podcasts called Lifelines. And it's a more in-depth conversation about mental health. And so if you are someone who wants to learn a little bit more or found today's conversation encouraging, I would encourage you, go give that a listen. You can find that series on the Christ Church Media Library at christchurch.us. That same link is the place that I would encourage you. Lastly, if you are interested in our Lenten sermon series called Messy, the Challenge of Loving People Like Jesus, again, it talks about the fact that life is messy, life is hard. We are all on this journey together. I would encourage you, check that out on our media library as well. Alrighty, friends, I'm done talking for the day. I'll be dropping another episode in 2 weeks, so be sure to come back and join us for that. Until then, be sure to pay attention to how God is calling you to go deeper still and go in his grace.